Access number 28670, Mr. David Wilson, Real 4. Now, how did they teach? I mean, we're talking about rifle training with the Lee Enfield. Now, how did they set about that? Did they teach you how how to hold it, how to stand and fire? Before you went on the range, or did they teach you when you were on the range? How did they teach you to fire?
No, the sessions with the weapons training were part of the, I suppose you would call it the curriculum. You would perhaps have a session drill on the square, or maybe even from a PT session, you would have weapons training, and the whole platoon used to be split up into groups, because each hut had its own corporal and lance corporal instructors. You were split up into groups, and you used to do sort of firing from the lying position, firing from the kneeling position, and they used to balance coins, I recall, on your on the end of the barrel, and you had to learn how to hold your breath,
now
take a bead.
Why did they put coins in
there? Well, this is so that when you, instead of pulling the trigger, the idea was to squeeze it and keep the rifle as still as possible, hold your breath, holding it back against the your shoulder. And when you squeeze the trigger, the coin was supposed to remain there and not fall off, like, you know. So that was part of it, I recall. And of course, you used to do that from kneeling and lying.
Did you find the positions natural ones, or did you have to have your legs kicked in place, or, you know?
Oh, they used to do that. Whether you were right or not, they used to come and kick your legs. When you had your toes dug in, they used to kick them apart so as to stabilise you, you know.
Did you find it reasonably natural position?
I did, yeah, I did. I found that I took quite well to the rifle.
Now, what about the aiming? They call it the principles of marksmanship. I mean, what do you remember about that? Did it come?
Well, of course, again, perhaps jumping ahead, but you had your rifle zeroed into you. And generally speaking, it was the platoon sergeant who used to come around doing that. But the first thing was to use the back sight in conjunction with the foresight, and line them up. But there again, the back sight was adjustable for distance. So you had to calculate distance, adjust your back sight, and then line them up and squeeze the trigger, you know. Hoping to keep it still at the same time. It was a coordination and quite a simple sort of thing to
How was it when you first got on the road? You'd been looking forward to
it. Oh, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
What was it like?
No, well, I recall marching down to the range for the first time. It was on one of the few occasions you got your tin hat on with perhaps a net on, and of course the dress for the range at that time of the year was just, again, denim trousers, second best working gear, boots and gaiters, and your shirt. And, of course, your ammunition pouches and your tin hat stuck on your head. And marching down as a platoon to the ranges in your tin hats, it felt as if you really had started to be a soldier. You were looking like one, at least. And you marched out the ranges onto the firing points, and there were 12 firing points, markers in the butts at the other end were the targets. And for the Lee Enfield, you had the 12 firing points were occupied. When you used the LMG, the Bren gun, which you were instructed on as well.
I'll come to that.
Right. That was every other one, you know. You got one magazine initially, and you fired your shots to enable the gun to be registered to you. And I remember getting a fairly close sort of grouping, and you were taught about grouping and single shots and you know, sort of the basic principles of aiming. And of course, the sessions on the ranges went right through the 6 weeks. It was one of the normal sort of.
Was there any concentration on speed of firing? I mean, the regulars had used to be famous for their speed of firing.
Yes,
but
yes,
that's a long time ago. I mean, did they do any trying to get you up to 15 aim grounds or was it just a matter of?
It was accuracy and using the weapon. I cannot remember ever being harassed about speed. I didn't. Perhaps with it being a core like Remy, it wasn't thought as being so important, you know.
And you were a reasonable shot.
Oh yes, yes, I was quite proud of me groups. If I didn't get them in the bull, I got them somewhere near, and then once I knew where it was, when the marker came up, I used to get them more or less in the same place, you know.
Now, anything else about rifle training? Or?
Well, it's, in using the drill, when you were drilling, I'm not a great big chap. I used to find the Enfield was quite a weighty object. I believe it was 9 pounds, 9¾ pounds, as I make it. It weighed, and after a drill session with the rifle on the parade ground, you knew about it. You know, it was very wearing.
What about bayonet training? Did you do any of that? This is charging at the dummies, or bayonet fencing, or any form of bayonet training?
Not a lot. I can recall one session. With the bayonet, it was this short 8-inch round one, charging at sacks with straw in. But there wasn't a great emphasis placed on it. The other part of the that we did get involved with the bayonet was simply on the drill square, learning as part of the drill to fix bayonets and sort of come back to attention, put your bayonet back in your frog and still look military as you did it, you know.
Were they still doing all this business of shouting and screaming and bawling?
When oh, yes. Did the, right, yeah.
The attacks on them?
Yeah, you had to yell and shout.
Did you find that came naturally? Or?
No, I found it a bit embarrassing and undignified. As I say, I can only recall one session, and they didn't sort of repeat it.
Did you
afterwards.
Think it was an important weapon in your armoury?
Well, at the time, I probably didn't think about it, but in retrospect, it obviously was. You know, getting back to that was the time of Korea, and getting back to the Gloucesters, who ended up with no ammunition, only their bayonets to fight with. It obviously was still worth retaining the bayonet, you know.
Next, the light machine gun, the Bren.
The Bren, yeah.
Now, tell me about your Bren training. How far did it go with that?
Oh, yeah, the Bren I thought was a beautiful weapon.
Now, what's beautiful about it?
Well, it didn't have the kick of the Lee Enfield, and it was very accurate. And, of course, the sheer thrill of the automatic weapon rather than the single shot Lee Enfield was it was a real experience, and the only thing I recall which I didn't like about it, and I suppose you hope it didn't happen often, was this business of having a supposedly jammed gun and having to crawl up the side and alter the gas regulator and crawl back again, the number two, and then put a new magazine in, and and the sequence of that is something which I remember being a bit of a pain. And of course, stripping and reassembling the damn thing.
How bad was that?
It was pretty complex. Even though I was a mechanic, I found it quite complex, the Bren. But once you got the hang of it, it was automatic.
How far did they go with that? I mean, did they do the old blindfold trick or the dart in the dark, or was it just?
No, I can't remember either of those things. You were just taught to strip and reassemble it.
But you were Remy.
Oh yes, yes, yeah.
Now, Sten gun.
No, the Sten, we got Stens, but that was when I went to the Middle East.
But before that, you didn't have trains?
No, it was just the LMG, the Bren and the Lee Enfield.
How about hand grenades?
Oh, yes, yes, I had the 36 mils type hand grenade was the one. And again, not many sessions, but I can remember guys, it's Amaris mine, all right, you know, the drill, the removing the pin and lobbing the grenade. But I remember people sort of running about with grenades with pins out and frightening the living daylights out of everybody and not knowing what to do next and this type of thing. But again, there wasn't a lot of emphasis placed on it. Just one session to familiarise yourself. Oh, there was one.
You got to throw one, though.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, perhaps more than one.
You weren't so bothered as some, obviously. You just threw your...
Oh, no.
The other things.
No, managed to throw it in the right direction and drew the pin at the right time and counted the prescribed seconds off and then lobbed it. But the other thing I recall firing, just the once, which was enough for me, was a Piat, the anti-tank weapon, which was... It was difficult for me because it being relatively short, you had to load this damn thing, I remember, with your feet on a pair of extensions and then pull the spring up to cock it. And I used to get it just about there, like it wouldn't go any further, you know, and used to, like a pogo stick it was. And anyway, firing it was traumatic because the recoil from that was tremendous. The trench that you fired it from had a high parapet at the back that used to more or less lean against, lower parapet at the front. And when you fired it, you thought, oh, well, that was easy. And then a second or two later, the recoil used to spread eagerly against the back of the trench. As I say, there was only one session with that, but that was more than enough for me.
Did they introduce you to the 2-inch mortar?
No, we didn't do mortars at all.
Now, what about other forms of training? Any tactical exercises? You know, this pretending to attack or defend, that sort of thing.
Yes, we did night exercises, but that was just a minute. Not at Blandford.
Any tactical exercises at all there?
Barton Stacey. That was at Blandford. No,
so
it was all basic 6 weeks. Military training.
Any other sorts of training you recall? Route marches or
crossing? Oh yeah, the 5 mile bash. That was a sort of.
Now, what was a typical route march like? You know.
Well, it's again, you know, it's relatively fit at the time, and I didn't find it a real problem. The route marches were just sort of in and around. The quite extensive camp at Blandford, but they did do this five mile bash, which was in PT gear, and you had to make it, otherwise supposedly you didn't pass out, and you had to go back, you know, for a second session sort of style. But there wasn't many that didn't make it. In fact, I can't recall any in our platoon, and it was rigorous, it was hard work, but you know, it wasn't too bad. If you couldn't run all the time, you could walk a little bit and pick the pace up again when you got your puff back, you know. So
and cross country runs.
It was a road run rather than a cross country run.
But it was a run.
It was a run. Yeah, it was a run with PT gear on. Yeah.
And. So that you fitted in with that. Any other types of training you do during the day?
that was the inevitable interior economy where you had to keep the place clean. Which there was a few sessions which were down to that. You know, just simply dusting and cleaning.
How much work would you? How tidy or neat or spotless did they require you to have?
Spotless. It was absolutely spotless. they weren't against chucking stuff out of the window if they didn't think it was absolutely up to standard, and the standard was very high.
So how much work on the floor and then?
Well, the floor that wasn't really a problem. It was probably a cement floor in there. There was a potbelly stove in the middle.
I mean, would you have to polish that?
Yes, that was black leaded. And the room had to be well up the standard, certainly no dust about. But there wasn't a lot of stuff in the room, apart from the steel lockers.
Now, what about preparing for kit inspection?
Well, yeah, that was...
Take us through the whole year. I mean, what would you have to do to get your kit ready for a real inspection?
You had already got your best boots polished up to a very high standard.
How did you polish? Because people don't polish their shoes much. Certainly not the same way. How did you get? And they've got pimples on them when they're.
Yes, they have the crazed alligator skin type look when you first get them.
Now, how do you get your boots from that to what they want?
Well, you get all the various tips from this one and that one, but we used to use a small flat iron on the toe cap, just the toe caps, to get the irregularities out. Had to be very careful, otherwise you scorched it. And then it was a question of building up layers of polish by spit and polish on your yellow duster, your polishing duster. You had a polisher and a one to apply it, and building it up with circular motions, spitting on the thing all the time, till you got the toe cap caked, and let it harden in between. Do it maybe three or four coats on top of the first one, and let it harden, and then work on it for a couple of hours, buffing with a yellow duster,
a
clean, brand new, clean and dry yellow duster, till it was like a mirror.
Now, which bits of the? I mean, was it a unit that wanted the whole boot doing like this and the bottom? Or
no, it was. You could get away with a good, clean, brushed finish on the rest of the boot, but the toe caps had to be like a mirror. And of course, once you got them that way, you used to guard them as if they were very delicate, and going and drilling in them because sometimes you had to, if it was, best boots and gaiters drill session. This was towards the end of the training period, and like for passing out and this sort of thing. You immediately, when you got back, you brought them up to standard and stood them very carefully in your locker out of the way, So it was, there was great emphasis placed on the standard of, I didn't suppose it was up to guard's standard, but it must have been somewhere near that.
That's your best boot. Now, what about your other boots? What were they expecting?
Brushed, they were quite reasonable about that, in as much as it was clean, brush finish, nothing in the welts, no rubbish, but a brush.
No parade blood.
That was just on your best boot.
That's your boots. Now, what about buttons, button stick, brass work?
Oh, yeah.
How did all that work?
Well, the main thing, of course, was when you had a kit layout, the only brass buttons you had was on your greatcoat. And I recall having, again, getting back to when you initially issued your kit, you invariably get stuff that's the wrong size. And as I say, a guy as short as me, being sort of 5'5", 5'6", you got this great long greatcoat for somebody that was 6'6", and of course the 6'6" guy got this tiny little short greatcoat. So there's a lot of swapping of stuff till you eventually got the right sort of gear. And I ended up with this quite nice, supposedly, according to somebody, officers Great Coat, Australian Officer's Great Coat, which was a slightly different shade of khaki to the rest, but it was a nice one. And when I used the button sticker, because you got Remy buttons, not JS buttons, they were Remy buttons. And, oh no, that's right, they were issued with JS buttons, but you could buy Remy buttons and stitch them on. And I had the Remy buttons on, we used to bull them up, and that was a really nice coat. But the button stick fits behind the button, and you use your Brasso, on, put it on with the yellow duster, and then brush it. You used to use a soft brush, and it came up very nicely.
Now, what about your webbing and the whole thing of Blanco? Now, no one now knows what Blanco is.
Oh, well, this is it.
They just don't use it. Can you explain how you Blanco'd your webbing?
Well, the webbing when you got it was, it could be anything from new stuff to second-hand stuff that had already been Blanco'd. But the Blanco colour in this country, in fact, in the European theatre, was obviously green. It was a sort of lightish coloured green, and what you had to do was strip the belt, take the brasses off, lay it out, scrub it, prepare it, clean all the old rubbish off, and then you would take your Blanco, which was in a block, and you had a Blanco brush, an applicator, which you used to build up the layers of Blanco, not too thick so it would crack, but make sure that all of the webbing, the texture of the webbing was covered, and it was into the grain. And then you used to hang it up in a special drying room. And once you got your belt up to standard, of course, when the brasses were off, you had to clean them separately, except for the two buckles, which were still attached. You couldn't get them off at the back. Clean them on the job, make sure you didn't spoil the Blanco, and then put it all back together and very carefully lay it out, because if you had too much Blanco on, you put it on, it used to crack and come off, like, you know. So it was a question of just the balance of too much, not too much, but not too little. And of course, you had to do that with all of your webbing. You had your webbing belt, your cross straps, your ammunition packs, which went on them, and then your small pack, your big pack, and your bayonet frog, all of which had to be treated with the Blanco.
Now, what about the drying? You mentioned drying.
It was a drying room. Yeah, the drying room was in the centre part of the spider, along next door to the ablutions, and it had just a dark room with racks in, a bit like a drying cupboard and an airing cupboard, with louvers, and it had the hot water system, 4-inch pipes going around it, and it used to be really, it was like a sauna, it used to get hot, leave the stuff in there, it was dry, and watch that nobody else, if you had a good belt, you had to make sure you kept an eye on it, because somebody else would nick it and substitute it for their rotten one.
Now, what about ironing and things like that? Because a lot of lads then wouldn't know.
Well, I hadn't a clue. My mother used to look after all my stuff prior to going in, and ironing was something you had to learn. You had to do it, of course. You had to learn not to. I burnt my best BD on a couple of occasions, you know, and singed the. Because your best BD, you wanted to look like an old soldier. So, and they were hairy when you got them. You used to scrape the hairs off.
How?
Just with an old razor blade, just sort of did the tedious business of scraping, you know, to make them smooth. And you used to get them tailored. you could pay to go to the tailor and get your blouse, your BD blouse, boxed at the back, which was better than just the gathered arrangement, which was standard. You got away with that. But they also used to get iron the crease in the trousers and get the tailor to run a stitch down, which looked a bit ridiculous at times, because you had, if one that had got a bit baggy in the knees, the crease in the front used to come down and then go out over the knees and then come back again like this, which looked ridiculous, you know. But I never did that. I remember getting the just sort of Well, and of course, sometimes to maintain the crease, you would, when you got into bed, you would put it under the biscuits, under the palliasse, you know. And of course, when you first got them out, they had the spring marks was on it, like, you know. But they used to disappear when you were wearing them. But also all these little tricks that you had to learn, even putting the blankets on the bed, they would show you how to make a bed the way that they would do in the hospital, I suppose. And you had to do it that way. It all had to be tucked in because when
hospital corners,
and making during the day when you went out, you had to make your bed block up. With
now,
your,
that's also for inspections as well. Now,
well, it was.
How did you make it?
We did this every morning. Well, you had your white sheets. You had one brown blanket. Yeah, you had two green sheets and two white sheets. And you used to fold the brown blanket in a long strip. Fold your green and white sheets and alternate them so as to make a pattern. And then wrap the brown blanket round the whole thing and square it off so that it looked very decorative at the top of your bed. Then your pillow went on top of that, like, you know, and leave one green sheet over the actual mattress itself with the proper corners, and it had to be spot on. And of course, your bed space consisted of your bed plus your locker, and all of your webbing was on the top of the locker, properly set out, big pack, small pack, ammunition packs, one either side, you know. And with the packs, you used to square them off by cutting bits of cardboard and putting them down the inside so as to hold them square instead of sagging like a bag of rubbish, you know.
Would you lay your kit out on the bed?
Nearly every day you laid your kit out, as I've just described, but every maybe 3 days they would have a full kit inspection.
What would that be like?
Oh, that was horrendous. It was very worrying. The even had a stage where you had to lay out your cleaning materials, as well as you had a proper kit layout, and it was on the notice board, and you hadn't to deviate from it. But I remember one or two of the more ridiculous things was like your spare boot laces, which were leather. You had to coil them up like a coil of licorice and put some thread round, and they looked a bit like a Catherine wheel, but they had to be polished with the black boot polish and set out. Your mess tins had to be polished. There was a sort of pewter material, but they had to be polished so that you could see your face in them, and your knife, fork and spoon. But the most ridiculous thing in Blandford was you had to have one tin of boot blacking, a boot polish, that you scraped the paint off one of the faces off the lid and bulled it up so that it was like a mirror. And of course, as I say, your full kit was laid out, your webbing and your PT gear, in fact, everything that you weren't wearing, which at that time would just be your second best working gear, you know.
And what would it do if there was something wrong?
Oh, well, the troop sergeant, the platoon sergeant would come in with these underlings for an initial kit inspection. Sergeant Fifield it was, and Corporal Woodward and McAllister, the Lance Corporal, and they would parade around, with the usual comments about it being in such and such an order, and chucking stuff about that wasn't up to standard, and generally sort of terrorising everybody. And then you would have to do it all again, and of course he would come back with the platoon officer, and he would really go through it, And as I say, they weren't against throwing stuff out of the windows. Being that part of the year, the windows were open and they would just sling stuff out, you know, if it wasn't up to standard. And a lot of shouting and bawling and this sort of thing.
Did you mind?
After a while, no, not at all. Initially, yeah, it got, that was pretty, when they chucked your stuff out the window, you had sat up all night, blankly. I mean, that was pretty, yeah, no, it got to you then, but after a while, the standards went up, and I must say, that sort of treatment tapered off towards the end of the training period, and they actually started treating you in a reasonable fashion. It was all part of the hardening up process, I suppose.